Self-justification motivation, Luke 14:1-14:11, was presented by Larry Barber on August 11, 1996, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
And it's Luke's parable. And actually, it's Luke 14:1-11. And it's, first of all, the first section of the passage deals with Jesus healing a man with dropsy. And then the second section deals with these religious elite people picking out places of honor. And Jesus tells a parable to them. As I mentioned, I taught this parable 4 years ago, and it's striking to me that I thought that I understood it 4 years ago. And just my own thinking and my own understanding of what the scripture is saying, in particular my study of evil, has influenced me and influenced my thinking and my understanding of this passage. So it's going to be different than what I thought. I mean, and very much it's the same as I thought 4 years ago, but in another sense it's different. So although these two sections, there are two definite sections here, two definite separate incidents that take place in this passage, I think that they're really connected. And though they seem distinct and they seem separate, I think they're very much connected. For one, they happen in the same house, the same sort of historical setting. They happen in direct sequence to each other. And the people that Jesus relates the parable to are the same people that plant this man with dropsy. So the same people are there. And I think most importantly, I think the psychology that is operating with the invited guests when Jesus heals the man with dropsy is the same psychology that is operating when these men pick out places of honor at this gathering. So let me begin by reading the first section, and we'll start looking at it. And it came about that when he, this is Jesus, went into the house of one of the leaders of the Pharisees on the Sabbath to eat bread, they were watching him closely. And there in front of him was a certain man suffering from dropsy. And Jesus answered and spoke to the lawyers and the Pharisees, saying, "Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?" But they kept silent. And Jesus took hold of him, that is, the man with dropsy, and healed him and sent him away. And he said to them, "Which one of you shall have a son?" Or in some texts, Greek texts, it reads donkey. "Or an ox, fall into a well, and will not immediately pull him out on a Sabbath day." And they could make no reply to this. Well, the setting is that it was not uncommon at all for, after assembling at a local synagogue on the Sabbath and listening to the scriptures being read, for people who were serious about their relationship with God, and particularly the religious leaders of the time, to gather together in a private home for a meal. And during that time, they would sort of discuss the passage that had been read. They would talk about its meaning. They would talk about how it should be interpreted, and specifically how it would be applied. And so this was a very common thing that would take place. And Luke points out in verse 1 that the host of this particular Sabbath get-together was one of the leaders of the Pharisees. This person was most likely a member of the Sanhedrin. And Jewish tradition traces the origin of the Sanhedrin back to where God commanded Moses in the book of Numbers to pick out 70 men, so that he wouldn't have the responsibility of making decisions and settling disputes between people. The Sanhedrin was largely composed of chief priests, scribes, and Pharisees. It was very much a political sort of thing. As I mentioned, at this point in history, the number of the council numbered 71, and the extra man was generally the high priest. The Sanhedrin basically had complete control of all the religious affairs in the nation. They had authority over the interpretation of the Mosaic Law and its application. So the host of this sort of intimate gathering was more likely one of the most important and most powerful men in Jerusalem. Now the guest list was a number of Pharisees, lawyers, a man with dropsy, and Jesus. The Pharisees were basically a group of people who were considered to be fanatical in their efforts to obey the law. They kind of banded together in small groups, like a Bible study or a fraternity. And their whole purpose for getting together was to encourage each other to study, to know the law and the oral traditions, where the oral traditions are sort of a compilation of the interpretations of the law and how it was to be applied. But their purpose to get together was to really support and encourage each other to obey the law and the oral traditions. These were very deeply religious men who took their relationship with God very seriously. And they were considered to be sort of fanatical in their efforts to obey the law and the oral traditions. The second group of people that were there were the lawyers. And the lawyer was a title given to a person who was an expert in the law in the Old Testament. The lawyer devoted himself to studying, interpreting, and determining what the exact intent and meaning of a particular law was in detail so that the requirements of the law could be met. He devoted himself to teaching the law because he wanted people to obey the law. He also devoted himself to the practical administration of the law. If there was any question about the rightness or wrongness or of a given action or a situation or how a particular law was to be interpreted, the lawyer was the person that people would look to, the common people would look to for that sort of judgment or that decision. And his pronouncement was pretty much considered authoritative. And finally, a lawyer really spent some time sort of debating, discussing, and articulating the law with his peers and colleagues. And sort of the better that a lawyer could do this, the better a lawyer knew the law and could articulate it, and the more respected he was, the more looked up to he was by not only the people, but his peers as well. So what we have here in this gathering, at least up till now, apart from Jesus and this man with dropsy, are people who really felt and believe themselves to be on the best possible terms with God. They are the theologically correct of the first century. These are the sort of spiritual giants of the first century. They are the righteous. They are the ones who, from their perspective, are trusting God. They are doing it right. So these are some of the most prominent, important, significant, and religiously influential men in Jerusalem in the first century. Now the next guest seems to appear out of nowhere, and this is a man with dropsy. Now dropsy is an abnormal accumulation of, I'm reading this because it's kind of a little technical, because I don't remember it. Dropsy is an abnormal accumulation of a watery-like fluid in the tissues of the body or in one of the body cavities. It is more of a symptom of a more serious problem. It is the physical symptom of a faulty heart or a diseased kidneys. There is bloating of the face. Arms and legs may be greatly swollen and kind of have a doughy appearance. The abdomen feels like it's really hard, like a drum. And the pressure, the fluid against the diaphragm, makes it very, very difficult to breathe, and it's extremely uncomfortable. Now, those who were serious about their faith, such as these men here, would not associate with a person with a physical ailment such as this man with dropsy. He would be considered to be a man who had committed some kind of hideous sin against God, and that this ailment was really an indication that God was judging him, that he was under God's judgment. And anyone who fell into this category of being under God's judgment was not someone who the religious elite or people, these men, would have associated with at all. I'd like to, and this is where I sort of am going to change what I thought about before or think differently about what I thought. I think, in fact, that these men would look at this man with dropsy not only as an evidence that he was under God's judgment and that he had sinned, had some sin, or his parents had some sin of some sort, but they would look at this man with dropsy as an indication that they were doing it right, that they were in fact justified, that they were in fact righteous. And let me explain. This man with dropsy, again, from their perspective, he had done something wrong. He had done something hideously sinful against God. And because these men themselves had worked extremely hard not to sin, and they themselves had no such malady like this man with dropsy, or any other indication in their lives of God's judgment, they must be doing it right. In their eyes, in a twisted sort of way, the man with dropsy was further evidence that they were justified by God. The man with dropsy was wrong in their eyes. The man with dropsy was a sinner in their eyes. And they were right. And they concluded, in sort of comparing themselves, standing back and looking at this man and comparing themselves with him, they concluded that they were doing it right. He was wrong, they were right. That's what happened in their own mind, whether consciously or subconsciously. That's what happened. The context suggests also that this man with dropsy seemingly appears out of nowhere. The context also suggests that this group who is at this home is watching Jesus very, very closely. All this suggests that this man with dropsy is a plant. He is put there by these men. He is there precisely to see what Jesus is going to do. How is Jesus going to respond to the situation? He's healed people on the Sabbath before. He's done things on the Sabbath before that they wouldn't do. What's he going to do? Is he going to heal this man? I think Jesus is a very perceptive person, and he understands what is going on. He understands exactly why this man with dropsy is there, and he understands why he's there. He understands this, and he sees this, and he poses a question. A very specific and detailed question. He says, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? Again, according to these men, according to their interpretation of the law and the oral traditions, there was a very detailed, explicit prescription of what it looked like to keep the Sabbath holy. And in keeping this Sabbath day holy was one of the most important, one of the most significant, tangible, and meaningful ways that a person who was serious about their relationship with God could demonstrate that commitment, could show that they were serious about their relationship with God. These men, or people like these men, or people who were serious about their relationship with God, from these people's perspective, interpreted the law such that healing on the Sabbath constituted work, constituted labor, which violated the commandment to keep the Sabbath day holy. It's really interesting because it's very convenient, because these are the men who interpreted the law. These are the men who determined what would constitute violating the Sabbath or not. So in a sense, they were in a place and a position to write their own law, to determine for themselves, and they decided for themselves. It's very convenient. Luke records the lawyers and the Pharisees' response to Jesus, and he says that they kept silent. They didn't have a thing to say in response to Jesus' question about would it have been right or not for him to heal this man. Well, you know what happens next. Jesus heals this guy. And in healing this man, I think Jesus demonstrates that having compassion for and healing this man with dropsy is not at all inconsistent with keeping the Sabbath. But Jesus goes on and he explains. He says, which one of you shall not have a son or an ox fall into a well and will not immediately pull him out on a Sabbath day? Again, as I mentioned, from the perspective of these religious men, working on the Sabbath constituted a violation of keeping the Sabbath holy. And in their mind, Jesus had just provided them with the clear and questionable evidence that he was not a righteous man. In fact, in front of all these witnesses. However, as Jesus reminds them of the law, of their own law, that the Mosaic law specifically stated that a righteous man had regard for the life of his beast, such that if an ox or a donkey or a son, depending on how you read the text, were to fall into a well on the Sabbath, that it would not have been a violation of the law to rescue the animal. In fact, it could very well be a violation of the law to not rescue the animal, because it says a righteous man has regard for his beast. Jesus' point here goes something like this. If an animal should fall into a well on the Sabbath, it's not a violation of the Mosaic law to rescue him. Then it certainly would not be a violation of the Sabbath to heal a man of a physical ailment such as dropsy on the Sabbath. If it's okay to do this, then it's okay to do that. That's Jesus' point. That's his logic. Well, these guys have nothing to say this. They don't respond at all. They have nothing to say. On one level, Jesus here is exposing sort of the inconsistency between... And it's really difficult to say whether... Well, I'm sure on one level that they knew the law. These guys knew the law frontwards and backwards. On another level, it would have been very inconvenient for them to not remember this other part of the law which said that it was a righteous man had regard for his beast, and it would have been okay in their minds to rescue a beast if he'd fallen into a well. But on another, one thing Jesus is doing here is sort of confronting and exposing the inconsistency that they had with the law. But I think there's something much more important going on another level. Why are these men trying to find fault with Jesus? What possible motive could they have for this? What is the psychology that's operating here? Well, imagine for a minute that you are one of these men. Imagine what it would be like to be one of these men. You are a powerful person. You are respected. You are looked up to for answers. You're a person who is supposed to have the answers in terms of what the law means and how it's to be interpreted and how it's to be applied. So people look to you. It's a very powerful position. Now imagine what it would be like to be one of these men and to have Jesus come on the scene. He claims to be from God. He does miracles. He feeds multitudes of people with very little stuff to work with. He heals people on the Sabbath. He's not impressed or intimidated by these men. He teaches a very different message from the one that they do, and people are responding to them. I think at this point in Jesus' ministry, he's very popular. He is not at all like these men. He associates with sinners. He does things and says things that these men would never do or say. He is very, very different, and he claims to be from God. This is a problem. This creates a kind of internal conflict that these men may or may not be conscious of. But it's being played out in their lives and how they relate to Jesus. If they can find something... Is this thing on? Good, because I didn't turn it on. I just thought about it. If they can find something wrong with Jesus, then that puts a very big feather in their cap. It would first demonstrate that Jesus was wrong, that he is not who he says he is. It would clearly indicate that he was not from God. And in their minds, exposing Jesus as a fraud was the right thing to do. It was keeping the faith. It was protecting the faith from their perspective. But more importantly, it would be again an indication to them that they were right, that they were the righteous, that their way of relating to God was the correct way. Because if they can show that Jesus is wrong, that makes them right. On a very personal level, there is a lot at stake here for these men in this sort of conflict that they have with Jesus. If Jesus is wrong, then they have nothing to worry about. But if he is right, then they are wrong. And their whole way of seeing themselves, their whole way of seeing God, their whole way of relating to God is called into question. And that is a very scary proposition. That is a very frightening thing to think about. It is the psychology of self-justification that is operating in these men when they look at the man with dropsy and they conclude that they are different from him. They conclude that he is wrong, that he is a sinner, and that they are right, and they are not sinners, that they are the righteous. It is the psychology of self-justification that is operating when they do that. It is also the psychology of self-justification that is operating when these religious men place the man with dropsy in front of Jesus, hoping that he will heal him, hoping that Jesus will heal this man. Because if he does it on the Sabbath, what that means is, to them, in their minds, in how they've worked this all out in their own minds, is that Jesus is wrong, but more importantly, they are right. Because they would again contrast themselves, by way of contrast, they are right. And Jesus would be wrong, because Jesus is doing something that they wouldn't do. So, we've looked at this section here. Let's move on and look at this next section. And Jesus notices... Question.
They were placing being right and showing themselves as being right.
Yeah.
Well, mindset at all, because even if they didn't plant this guy with dropsy, they didn't answer what Jesus said.
That's right.
It's different language when Jesus asked a lot of them on the Sabbath, they kept silent.
That's right.
Very different language than they can make no reply. They decided not to respond. And so they were deciding to be hurtful toward another person.
Right.
At the very least here, even if Jesus wasn't God in it.
That's right. They were placing their interpretation of the law and their being right, and their being right, well, actually, more importantly, they were placing their being right and their need to be right over above compassion for a man who's sick.
And over and above Jesus. They were trying to...
Over even above being honest with Jesus, being honest with themselves, or being forthright. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Well, I think more explicit. I think if you say loving Jesus, it gets lost. I think more specifically, I think they were placing their need to be right over and above their being honest, or being forthright about Jesus' logic about the law, and they were being placing their interpretation of law, or their need to be right, over and above being compassionate to another man, a human being with a physical ailment, which makes a huge statement. These are men who are completely committed and invested in seeing themselves as right and sort of screw the rest of the world. No matter if it comes up and confronts them right in the face and says, "You're wrong." Let me move on, because I'm going to talk more about that a little bit. So Jesus immediately after following this incident with healing this man, Jesus notices that there's these invited guests and that they've been picking out places of honor at the table. And let me read this parable. When you are invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not take the place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you may have been invited by him. And he who invited you both shall come and say to you, "Give place to this man," and then in disgrace you proceed to occupy the last place. But when you are invited, go and recline at the last place, so that when the one who has invited you comes, he may say to you, "Friend, move up higher." Then you will have honor in the sight of all who are at the table with you. For everyone who exalts himself shall be humbled, and he who humbles himself shall be exalted. It's an interesting advice on Jesus' part. On a surface level, it appears as though Jesus is asking these men, these invited guests, who are picking out places of honor, to be sort of coercive and manipulative and falsely humble. They are to, rather than pick out the place of honor and risk the possible disgrace, embarrassment and shame of having the host come and ask them to move to a lower place, Jesus proposes instead that they sit in the place of least honor, the last place. They are to do this so that when the host sees them sitting in the last place, the host will come and ask his guests to move to a higher place, a more honorable place. And the result will be that everyone there will observe the host moving you, me, from this last place to the higher place, and that we will get the recognition that we want, that we think we deserve, actually. Because the higher the place, the more recognition. Well, do they take Jesus' advice or not? What if in taking the lower seat, the host comes and greets you and then walks off, leaving you in the last place? If in taking the lower seat, you are counting on the host coming and moving you up to a higher place, if that's what you were counting on, you're stuck. It would be much too embarrassing at this point to move to a higher place now. And the chances of having the host move you back to the lower place are even greater. I don't think that's what Jesus is actually doing here. I don't think that he's actually giving them that kind of advice. I don't think that Jesus is into false humility, and I don't think that's his style. I think what Jesus is doing here is, well, let me back up for a minute. The parable is about, again, the psychology that is operating these men as they pick out places of honor. They are picking out places of honor because they want the recognition they think they deserve. They want to be validated, or they want the validation from each other that they are who they think they are. They want other people to recognize them as being who they think they are. They want other people to recognize them as being the righteous, the justified, and they want other people to give them the recognition, the validation that they think they deserved, which comes out of how they see themselves. What Jesus is doing here is inviting these religious men. He's not encouraging them to be phony or to exercise or practice false humility. He's asking them to sort of engage in sort of a mind experiment. He's in trying to engage them to think about his advice. And if they were to take his advice, what would happen is that they'd have to come face to face with the reality of what's really going on here. They would have to come face to face with the reality that they are not the men they thought themselves to be. They'd have to think about why they're doing what they're doing and what this whole thing is all about. They are not men who trust God. They'd have to see that. They are self-reliant men who trust in themselves. They are self-reliant men who are only interested or mostly interested in seeing themselves as right, as seeing themselves as righteous, and gaining recognition and validation that they are right with other people. And by telling the parable and engaging them into participate in it by thinking about Jesus' advice, Jesus is pulling back the facade and exposing these men and what is motivating them to do what they do. He is exposing the psychology of what's operating here. What these men really care about is how they see themselves and what other people think about them. If they were really cared about pleasing God, they would have rejoiced in the healing of the man with dropsy. They would have been amazed. They would have appreciated what Jesus had done. They would have been thankful to God. They would see compassion as much more important than they do, because compassion is something that is important to God. If they really cared about God or what God cared about, they would gladly take the last seat, because in their heart they would know that that's what they really deserved. The first section of this passage, Jesus confronts the inconsistency of these religious men's interpretation of the law, but more importantly, what it is that's motivating that interpretation. It is their own desire for self-justification. In the second section of this passage, Jesus goes a little bit step farther and engages them in this farther in this sort of asking them to think and mull about and think about his advice to them, and confronts again this issue, this psychology of self-justification that is operating in as they pick out seats of honor and their desire for validation of that recognition. Let me make some application here, and then let's talk about it. It seems to me that when Jesus heals this man with dropsy, or has healed any man, anybody on the Sabbath, these men have three options. They can interpret Jesus' behavior as a violation of the Mosaic Law. They can accuse Jesus of operating under the influence of the devil. They could consider the healing as a possible miracle from God and use it as a catalyst to rethink their understanding of who God is and what is really important to Him. Those seem to be the three options. These men choose one and two. And as a result, they consistently try to trap Him. They consistently try to trip Him up with asking Him questions. Again, trying to demonstrate that Jesus is wrong. This is not an isolated incident in the New Testament in terms of how these men related to Jesus. They were consistently trying to trap Him. They were consistently trying to trip Him up. They were trying to prove that Jesus was wrong. And if Jesus is wrong, by contrast, they are right. And that's the psychology of self-justification. Finally, what these people did is they saw to it that Jesus was killed, just so they wouldn't have to look at themselves, just so they wouldn't have to live with any kind of discomfort that they could be wrong. Now, it would be sort of easy to look at these guys and think, well, they've just got their theology wrong. They've just got their priorities backwards. If we could just sort of educate them and if they could really understand what was really important to God, things would be different. They would relate to people, they would relate to Jesus, they would relate to God much differently. Everything would be better. But that's not the problem here. The problem is not bad theology. The problem is that these men are sinners and they've forgotten that. The problem here is that these men are self-deceived and they don't know it. And the problem is that these men are so invested in being right and having a need to be right that they're willing to sacrifice the well-being of another person, and they're willing to sacrifice being forthright or upfront or honest with themselves and Jesus. So they'll let compassion and honesty and forthrightness go over and against being right themselves. That is a huge statement about what's really important to them as it plays itself out in people's lives. Now, it's easy to sort of step back. I imagine for me it's the same as it is for you. And it's easy to sort of look at the New Testament or look at these stories and sort of step back from them and look at them and sort of think, well, you know, I don't have the same theology that these guys have. I'm different from these guys. Just so that we won't do that, I want to have an exercise here. I want you to imagine for a minute that Wes or Jack or somebody were to stand up here this morning and announce that next week, instead of listening to a regular teacher, that Sunday Night Live was going to have a very, very special guest, someone like R.C. Sproul, somebody like, who can you think of? Who? What's Billy Graham? That's who I was trying to think of. Somebody like Billy Graham, somebody really, really important in the evangelical world. And the reason that Jack was making this announcement was because he needed a couple to volunteer to host this man and his wife. And he was asking the question, who would be willing to have a small, not only to have them stay in their home, but who would be willing to have a small intimate dinner party as a way of welcoming and honoring this man and his wife. And what Jack really needs is somebody to do it right. A warm, wonderful, engaging, entertaining couple. Sounds like us, doesn't it? Who will make this guest feel comfortable and at the same time very special and very welcome. A couple that will reflect what Reformation Fellowship is really all about. We're in deep trouble. Let's just go with this, okay? I mean, there's a point here. Now, let yourself imagine for a moment that Jack actually got up and did this and made this announcement. Imagine what it would be like to have someone like that in your home. How do you respond to Jack's invitation? You could quickly raise your hand and implicitly saying that you're the person who's right for this job.
Actually, we thought we'd volunteer Christine.
Well, just wait. But that could be risky. Think of the embarrassment and the humiliation in raising your hand and saying that you would be glad to volunteer and have Jack say, well, thanks, but no thanks. Jack, in his own mind, is thinking of someone else. Other option. You could believe that you were the perfect person for the job. And rather than immediately raise your hand and volunteer, you sit quietly and wait. You wait for someone, other person, to raise their hand and say, you know, Christine would be the person. They would be the one who would be, or who, anybody else would be the perfect person for the job. And you're counting on that. You're hoping for that recognition. Think what that would be like. The other option is, what if you say nothing and no one recognizes you or say anything at all? Now, again, this is kind of hard for us because we're a different sort of group. But that is the psychology that is operating in these men. These are men who have spiritualized, have institutionalized self-justification. They have made it a right thing, and they go at it hard. Let me make one other point, then we'll open it up for questions. And this might be more helpful in getting at what the psychology is here. Now, what's it like when you have an area of your life that's important to you, that you take great pride in, that you're good at, and someone comes along and challenges it and implies or actually explicitly states that you're doing it wrong? But think about that for a second. What is that like for you? How do you respond in a situation like that? You defend yourself. At least in your own mind, you defend yourself. I think that this psychology that is operating in these men is a psychology that operates in all of us. And I think that it is probably the most powerful psychology that operates in human, fallen men, mankind, than any other psychology. We have this desire for self-justification, and I think that desire is greater than anything else that we struggle with as fallen people. And I think what we're in process of as Christians, as believers, is, first of all, is seeing that and seeing the wrongness of it. Because that's what Jesus is trying to get these guys to see. And then calling it what it is and struggling with it, but not necessarily, I'm not saying have victory in it, because I think that's the state we're in, but not calling it good, but calling it what it is, because I think that's the struggle that we all face and all deal with day to day, is not experiencing the discomfort of what it means to be wrong, to be wrong and to be vulnerable being wrong. Questions about anything that I've said about the text or application or whatever? Dan?
And being wrong means thoroughly always wrong?
Well, no, I don't think thoroughly always being wrong, but it's let me think for a second. I think when it comes to human beings being wrong, whether it's just when it's something that's important to us, for example, I think if you were to come and tell me I parked in the wrong place, that wouldn't be too much of a big deal for me. But if you were to come to me and tell me, and if I'm not getting to this, let me know. If you were to come and tell me that I was doing it wrong playing basketball, that would be another issue. My response to you would be more extreme, would be bigger, because there's more at stake for me. These men had a lot at stake. And I think when we're in situations where we have a lot of ourselves and our worth and whatever invested in being right, and someone tells us that we're wrong, I think how we respond is a very important indication of this psychology that's working, of this psychology of self-justification. So,
I assume that this goes deeper than specific parking problems.
Like, sure.
Every motivation, every moment.
Yes. Yeah.
In the way we think of ourselves.
Exactly. Yeah. I really think it has to do with the fall and the consequence of the fall, in that there's something significantly, well, I think there's two issues. I think that there's something significantly wrong with us. And on some level, we know that, or we sense that, or maybe we're in complete denial of it, but there's something really, really wrong with us, on one hand. On the other hand, it's really interesting to me, in Genesis 3:23, Moses writes that the Lord describes mankind after the fall. He says that they become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And what that means, and rather than explain what I think it doesn't mean and why it doesn't mean that, let me just tell you what I think it means. I think what that means is that we have put ourselves, and this is God's description of mankind after the fall. Mankind has put himself in God's place and deciding what is right and what is wrong for himself. That is God's description. That is all about self-justification. Because there's something wrong with us, and we fight that. We fight seeing that. We don't want to see that. We don't want to feel that. We don't want to experience that.
The wrong thing that we do is to self-justify ourselves. We have to self-justify even that.
Exactly. Exactly. It just goes. Exactly. And I think it's pervasive. One second.
You wouldn't say it's bigger now than it has been.
It's been big along. It happened. It's true back in Genesis, and it's true in the New Testament, and it's true now. Yeah. Miffy.
I want to just make sure I'm understanding what you're saying. Going back to your story about Jack standing up.
Right.
That's
hard to apply to this group, but you get the point.
Well, let me change his need. Say he stands up, or say somebody stands up and says, I need a really good Bible teacher, so they can really interpret the scripture.
Okay.
And in the group is Ron and Jack and David, or whoever.
Okay.
Or say another person stands up and says, I need a really good guitarist.
Okay.
Play at a festival that's coming up.
Okay.
And there's three good guitarists sitting in the group.
Okay.
I want to make sure that I'm not thinking that it's just the entertainer that is getting labeled as...
Right, no. The only reason I use the entertainer is because that's what's going on here.
Okay, so my question is... So this little scenario that I just set up, the teacher and the guitarist and
right.
the entertainer.
Right.
It seems as though the reason the parking is not a big deal is that anybody can do that. Anybody can park.
Or anybody can park and park in the wrong spot. And there's not a lot at stake.
But the dilemma in life, it seems, is with the scenario that you gave, is it's twisted up with this gift that God gives us, particularly for your own self, whatever God gives you as your strength.
Yeah.
And then our sinful nature can twist that and pervert it.
Exactly.
And so it seems so ingrown because it's what God gave us. Our personal signature gift, and yet how we can twist it and make it perverse.
Yeah, I think that's true. I don't think that it's... I think that's very true. I think the things... No, I am saying that. That would be included in what I'm saying. And I think on some level that probably if Jack were to stand up and say, who could teach, that's probably more appropriate for this group because there are some very gifted teachers here as opposed to people who could host Billy Graham. I don't know why I have a block on his name. Anyway, that would be more appropriate. And the reason I use that sort of analogy or that story is because of the host in the parable. But I think what you're saying is true, that those things that we... God gifts us with, or that we feel best about, or feel good about ourselves, that we take pride in, and it's even in a good sense. Those are the areas that we're probably more susceptible to that kind of psychology than any other. That's not to say, though, that that kind of psychology couldn't be true in another area of our lives. Does that make sense? But I think you're right. I think that's a good point. Marilyn.
Just as an example, the example you gave made me feel very uncomfortable. Your examples didn't, because I know.
And you don't want to be.
And I can't play the guitar. But
yeah.
I could maybe consider that other one.
Yeah.
And I felt my inside just quivering.
Yeah.
I wanted to bring up a slightly different story.
Okay.
Having more to do with the first
parable.
Part of the passage.
First part of the passage, okay.
And I just would be interested in your comments on
okay.
this story. Billy Graham is coming to town, and he's coming, and we're going to have a little, I don't know, rather than a dinner party, we're going to have a lecture series. Or some sort of symposium where he's going to
Oktoberfest
or something like that. And
okay.
We're concerned, like Pharisees, we're concerned that Billy Graham is not teaching the truth. And so what we want to do is we want to come up with the right question to trap Billy Graham, to expose the fact that he's not telling the truth.
Yes.
So that he can get his teaching back in line
right.
with the scriptures.
Right.
Which is certainly what the Pharisees were after.
Sure.
That what they wanted was Jesus to teach what's right.
Right.
And not go out and do these heretical, horrible things that he was doing. Now,
I think that's true.
I mean, it seems like there's a lot of analogies there. I mean, was what they were doing wrong, and what they were doing right.
Okay.
I mean, would we be just as guilty as the Pharisees to...
I suspect we have been. I mean, I suspect in our normal day lives, we all have been. But I mean, I think that's true, and certainly that would be included in how I would interpret the passage. But again, I don't know, maybe it's just the fact that I'm a counselor and I look for this stuff. But I think that these guys, again, like I say, this is not just an isolated incident in the New Testament. This is a pervasive thing, and they're trying to kill this guy. I mean, this is big stuff. This is huge. And I mean, on a scale of 1 to 10, their response to Jesus is not a 2, it's a 9, or a 9.5, or when they kill him, it's a 10. So what that says to me is there's something going on here beyond just my concern for truth. And what I know about reality is that I bring myself with me wherever I go, and that I bring myself, I bring my sin, I bring my worldview, I bring my own beliefs, and all that with me where I go. And I think what's true for me is also true for them. And so I bring what I understand the scriptures to be saying about humanity with I bring that into my understanding of how I read the New Testament as well, or these interchanges, exchanges with Jesus and these other people. And so I think that I just can't imagine that these people, these Pharisees, these religious people, are that squeaky clean. And that part of the reason I can't imagine them being that squeaky clean is because Jesus doesn't see them that squeaky clean in his other interactions with them. And I think that, again, I try to put myself in their shoes, and I try to imagine what it would be like, particularly having people respond to Jesus the way they are at this point in his ministry, and the fact that Jesus is doing all these miracles that they can't do. I mean, what would that be like? It's not just that Billy Graham is coming in and he's and he's not, hasn't got it right, and we want to correct him. But it would be like Billy Graham, who's got this, from my perspective, from our perspective, he's got this bad theology, but he's healing people. He's doing all these miracles. He's feeding multitudes. He's doing all this stuff. And we're going, I mean, on some place in my conscious or subconscious, I've got to be thinking. Absolutely.
Jesus had a certain amount of authority, even though they didn't
recognize it. Yeah, but they didn't recognize it.
Whereas for us, it's a question of understanding and reading.
I think that this whole Jesus coming on the scene has created an incredible internal conflict for these guys, whether they're going to talk about it on an honest or forthright level, which they've indicated or evidence that they won't, at least with him. So it's got to create this huge conflict, internal conflict for them. And what I know about human nature is that we defend ourselves, that we, it's really uncomfortable for us to admit that we're wrong in areas that are important to us and where there's a lot at stake for us.
Well, it just seems like the difference between Jesus, what he was doing, is they were being confronted with the truth.
Yes.
And they were willing to sacrifice that.
That's right.
To keep their place in their own.
And these are people who are purportedly committed to the truth.
Right. Whereas with yours, it seems like more of a difficult situation is what's the right way to confront somebody with the truth. So it seems like a little different situation as far as.
I don't know if that's how I heard Chris's thing.
Okay. Anyway.
Well, I don't know. I mean, they thought that they were right.
Absolutely.
Right.
They were defending
right.
the faith.
Whereas with your situation, we think we're right, whereas the teacher's wrong. So there's kind of, and what's the motive?
Right. Yeah.
There's, I don't know. What I got out of the teaching clearly was that they were willing to sacrifice the truth to keep their own position in there.
Absolutely.
And
why? Because of their need, the psychology of self-justification.
Right.
Exactly.
So then I have a question, because the first half I got that, the second half with the whole dinner party thing,
yeah.
I am not getting the self, I need a little bit of...
Well, part of the issue with self-justification is I want validation that I'm right. And where I sit, maybe I didn't explain this.
If that's what it is.
Yeah, that's what it is. Where you sat in the first century culture, there was an order, and the higher in the order, the more important you were. Part and parcel with the package of self-justification is I want validation. I'm not just going to go out on a limb and say I'm cool. I want you to notice that I'm cool and validate that I'm cool. Sherry.
To me, it seems like two responses we can have. Either we can get defensive, or we can self-doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Asks us
yeah.
to do something,
yeah.
we either think we can do it or
yeah.
we think that we can't do it.
Yeah.
So, in
yeah.
the situation that you're talking about, what generally is the best response if you were truly godly and you were actually getting the best response? It seems like under certain situations where you don't want to compromise the truth, but you don't want to be acting like you know everything and also compromising, compassion, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So I was just wondering what is the third response? Is it just being open to...
I think being open, thinking about it, dialoguing about it.
Taking a risk, being humble,
Being truly open, not just sort of dialoguing about it, just to have your own position or for more evidence for your own position, but really be open and being humble and being willing to be wrong.
I've been in situations where someone is so much smarter and like a given.
Mm-hmm.
Say we're talking about evolution or whatever
mm-hmm.
it is. And there's a tendency to not even want to go there.
Well, this is a very bright group, and it doesn't mean a thing. I mean, it's a wonderful gift. It's kind of like the analogy that Miffy brought up. This is a very, very bright gift or group, and the gift. I mean, we have to guard that because where we're gifted or where we're strong at, or this, as a group as a whole, that's where this psychology, I think, is even more dangerous. So being bright doesn't guarantee a thing. These guys in the first century were extremely bright. These guys were driven to know the Bible frontwards and backwards, and they knew it. But their brightness, if you will, got in the way. It was complicated by the fact that they're sinners. So there's no guarantees about any giftedness that any of us might have that's going to protect us from this kind of self-deception.
What's our highest goal is to just be compassionate and also to be merciful and also be loving. It isn't about being smart.
Yeah. Yeah.
The best.
Yeah. And that when we find ourselves, which we will, self-justifying, call it what it is, by the grace of God.